Well, if you were not here this morning, then you missed out on our opening of our series of lessons on the elders. But nonetheless, we will briefly recap that series, or that lesson, I should say. And what we talked about this morning is that the elders and the congregation need to have a mutual understanding of the role of elders and also the congregation's relationship to the elders. It's not just focusing on elders and picking on them in particular. That's not what we're doing. But rather, we're looking at the balance, the cooperation, the mutual dependency of those two groups working together, the elders, the congregation. As far as the lesson and the series is concerned, we're trying to be as neutral and objective as possible. We're not singling out Dick and Richard, for example, our present elders, and we're not saying that any candidates for elders are being scrutinized over and above what they should be. We're just simply looking at the subject here. This is a topical series, okay? And then we also said that God's plan is to have elders in his churches, and these men must be qualified to be elders, but they also must be doing the work. In other words, we can't just have, them meet the qualifications, then we nominate them and put them into that position, and then we all forget about what it is they were there to do. So we're not just filling positions, we're actually looking for men to do that work. We also looked at the fact that elders provide spiritual leadership and direction to the congregation. At least that's what they're supposed to do. And the congregation's responsibility is to submit to that leadership and support those men in what they do. And also, as a final note, we said that the time to prepare men for the eldership is the years prior to their nomination. Not the weeks, not the days, but the years prior to that. You can't wait until you have an opening, for example, to suddenly nominate someone and say, well, Jim Bob's been thinking about, this or that, or Brother Frank's been thinking about this or that for a while, and now we have an opening. Someone died or someone moved or something like that, and let's go ahead with that. There needs to be a lot more thought into, that preparation time than just, an opening there. So the importance of the elders can be seen also in their absence. We could ask the question, what if we remove the elders from the congregation? And how would that affect us? How would that impact what we do? And if you answer with a heavy sigh and go, oh, business meetings, and think that, the reason why we have elders is so that we can all escape business meetings. This series is for you. Because what you're doing when you say that, if indeed you were daring to say that, is that you don't understand the importance of the elders in the first place. And what if we were to ask the question, what if the elders were corrupted? I don't think our elders are, but what if they were? What if they were corrupt men who are just seeking their own agenda? They were immoral, they were greedy, they were self-serving, they were ungodly men. Would that have a negative effect on us? Well, of course it would. And we're going to actually talk about that later, the effect, later in this lesson. We'll talk about that. Only when elders conform to the biblical standard and the biblical principles are they beneficial to us. Otherwise, they can actually lead to our ruin as a congregation at least. Okay? So that's important for us to know. So we don't have elders just to escape business meetings, which has its own set of misunderstandings. We have elders. We should have elders, first of all, because God has so directed in his word. And quite frankly, if there was no other reason than this, this should be sufficient. I have long said to people who resist being baptized, they say, well, what are all the scriptures and the arguments and, why should I do it? Listen, if God tells you to be baptized, that by itself should be good enough. Right there, we could stop. And the same here with elders. If God says, I want elders in every church, then we could say, okay, that's what he wants, that's what we're going to do. But we can go on and also say that this follows the New Testament apostolic pattern, the pattern that was established by the apostles for the early churches, which is, of course, germane to our study because we're following that same pattern now. And also, we could say that groups of people need leadership, as we admitted this morning, and that's true in any group, a family, a congregation, a softball team, okay, your workplace. We need leadership. If we're going to come together as a group of people, there has to be leadership and there has to be followership. Remember I said this morning, what good are leaders if no one follows them? And then what good are followers if there's no one to lead them? We need to have both of those together. And also, our leadership has to come from within, not from without. We don't go scouring the neighborhood or the community for elders to lead us here in this particular congregation, but we promote from within, so to speak, right? So we need to have people who are understanding their role to this congregation and are also members of this congregation to lead us in a certain direction. And then finally, and we're going to focus on this most of all in this particular lesson, we're to follow the older, the wiser, and the experienced men and women who also follow Christ. We're to follow those examples. I'm not saying women can be elders. That's not what I meant by that. But I do mean that elderly men and elderly women both provide role models and mentorship for a congregation. So, elders are supposed to have a positive spiritual impact upon the group. They're not just figureheads. They're supposed to offer something to the congregation. And as we said, the congregation is to respond. Elders are accountable to the group. The group is accountable to the elders. And all of us are accountable to Christ. Good so far? Now what I want to do in this lesson in particular, this lesson is called Elders of the People. What we're going to do is look into the Old Testament in particular and say how were elders used then so that we can better understand the pattern that God had already put into place and then used in a church context later. This is extremely valuable. And what we see in the Old Testament is that elders are overseeing and shepherding God's people. This is not a new thing, in other words. Elders don't just pop into existence in the church without having historical precedent. So we have several instances in the Old Testament of that, and we're going to talk about that. Let me say it this way. In the ancient world, in Israel and everywhere else, elders of the people served as the civic and often the spiritual overseers and guardians of each city. That's their role in general. There are more specific roles, of course, but generally speaking, the elders served as the guardians of their own society, specifically of the cities that they belonged to. You've heard the expression, you know, the elders are the judges at the gate of the city. Job talks about that in the passage we read, which we'll get back to in a minute. And that idea there is that the older men, the elderly men, not just because they're old, but because they are experienced and wise and trained for this, that they serve as the judge for the cases that are brought to them. So elders in the Old Testament actually comes from a word, a Hebrew word, which means old or aged or senior. In fact, our word senator actually is derived from that same meaning there. And that includes governmental or administrative roles in civic matters. In other words, it's not just a religious role. When we look at the Old Testament, we're looking at a civil position, if you will, or a civic responsibility as well as a religious one. Now, someone says, well, how old? Well, that's up for debate, and it depends which society you're looking at. Our society recognizes a number of different age groups. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. I never really thought about that, but we have infants, we have toddlers, we have children, we have pre-adolescents, we have adolescents or teenagers, and then we have young people who are 20-somethings and 30-somethings, then we get into, then you get thrown into that vague, nebulous middle age, right? Which has no distinction anymore. And then you turn 55 and now you can get discounts at Denny's. So then you get into more of the senior part of your age, and then, you know, respectfully, then you get older and elderly, I suppose, right? So we have a number of different distinctions. In the Jewish society, for example, there were basically three. You are a child, you're a young man, or you're an old man. And there are huge blocks of time associated with each one of those categories, but that's how they recognized the life. And of course you're saying, well, what about women? Well, then you're a child, a young woman, or an old woman. Okay, so the old, the idea of old or senior was simply comparable to those who are younger. Usually the age is determined around 45 years old or thereabout, okay? Which bothers me because I'm a little bit older than that and I don't want to be called an elder by any stretch of the imagination, okay? We do have an interesting scenario there of Rehoboam, who became King Rehoboam after the death of his father Solomon there in 1 Kings chapter 12. I'm not going to go back and cite that, but you know the story probably where Rehoboam consulted with the elders. The old men, if you have the King James Version, the old men who were comparable to his father's age, and he consulted them, hey, what should I do going in as king here? And then he consulted with the young men. Well, what's interesting about that is that Rehoboam himself became king at age 41. And here he is being considered a young man. So what you find out is that, you know, a young man has a quite a stretch there, somewhere wherever childhood ends to wherever elders begin, okay? So there's quite a bit of stretch, and it's by comparison. It's an age that is determined by comparison. He's called young in comparison to Solomon's peers. All right, we could talk about that more, but I'm just throwing that out as an example there. So old man, or the phrase old man, in ancient Jewish society was a term of respect. It was a term of esteem and honor. Today, it has largely lost its distinction. Now old people are, you know, more expendable, sometimes get in the way. They're trouble for us because now we got to deal with them, and, you know, we've got to shuttle our schedules to take care of and accommodate. We got to wait for them as they cross the street because they take longer. You know, I mean, there's kind of a disrespect for older people and what they actually bring to the table, what they actually contribute to society, because they're just not as up on the technology and up on the standards of the day. I don't know if you've ever heard that. Maybe you have, okay? Old people are categorized as being unintelligent almost because they can't work a computer as fast as a teenager. And that's not a measure of intelligence whatsoever. It's not even close to a measure of intelligence. It's just a measure of competency on a particular gadget, which by itself doesn't mean anything. Because that teenager that can really go to town on a computer might be dumb as a rock when it comes to horse sense, okay? You know what I'm talking about? Whereas the older man may not know how to turn on an iPod or an iPad, but he knows about life, and he knows about virtue, and he knows about moral standards. So what I'm saying here is that just because young people might look at older people, you know, with a term of derision or, you know, not the respect that they deserve, that's not fair and that's not right. I'm not saying all old people deserve to be honored and respected. There's some old people that are, quite frankly, not deserving of honor and respect. That's another story. We're simply talking about generally speaking, okay? In fact, that's what we get in Scripture. In Leviticus 19:32, for example, God says, "You shall rise up before the gray-headed and honor the aged, and you shall revere your God." And there's a connection between honoring the aged and revering your God, in other words. And that comes out in some other verses as well. The idea was that the elderly represent the fathers or the patriarchs of the society, and age-wise, they are closest to God. As they get up in age, they're closer and closer to God. And if you disrespect those who are the closest to God, then you disrespect God himself, is the implication of that kind of statement there. Proverbs 16:31, a gray head is a crown of glory. It is found in the way of righteousness. Job 12, verse 12, wisdom is with aged men, with long life is understanding. These, of course, are ideal characteristics. Not everyone has them. Not everyone who's old has them. But generally speaking, this is what we should expect from those who are elderly, or those who are simply older compared to the rest of us, okay? As well, elders had a role or a function, or we could say a work in Old Testament times, not just because they're old, but because they are wise and discerning and therefore carried weight. And I'm not talking about abdominal weight here, okay? I'm talking about they had clout. They had influence. They had the ability to speak things and say things, and things would get done as a result of that because they had the respect of the people, okay? So we'll look at just briefly some specific roles that includes. This is hardly exhaustive, but for one thing, the elders accompanied Moses as he went to Pharaoh. You can read that there in Exodus 3:18, for example. And in fact, Moses often dealt with the elders directly rather than with the entire population of Israel. A lot of times when we're reading, Moses said to the people, we think that all of Israel is spread out before him, and that's really not the case. It is the elders of the people that are before him that have come out as the heads of family, the patriarchs that have come out and assembled themselves before Moses. Moses speaks to those people, and then they carry back to their clans, if you want to call them that, or their tribes, and they say, this is what Moses said. And that happens a lot, more than we probably realize. So they also received the foremost instruction and commands of Moses. Exodus 19, verse 7, for example, at Sinai, it says, Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And thus again, we have the heads of families, the patriarchs, the mediators between Moses and the people. In essence, between God and the people. Not saying Moses is God, but God is using Moses himself as a spokesman or a mediator. Specifically, we see the 70 elders and Aaron and his sons met with Moses at the base of Mount Sinai in Exodus 24 to ratify the covenant that was given to Israel. And that's where Moses took the had a sacrificial animal and took some of the blood from that animal and sprinkled it on the people and on the words of the book of the covenant and said, in essence, this is binding from now on. He didn't say it in those words, but that's what he meant by that sprinkling and by that action. And also, that's what's being referred to over in Hebrews chapter 9, for what it's worth, if you want to take time to read that. The elders also joined with Moses in presenting and enforcing the law to Israel. In other words, they weren't just hearers of the law. They also helped to enforce the law. They didn't just say, Moses, what do you have to say? And then we'll regurgitate it to the people. They heard those words, and they also acted as a body of authority. Not an authority unto themselves, but authoritative in the sense that they carried that word to the people and said, this is binding. This is law, people. And we've got to honor this for what it is. They were responsible for offering sacrifices for the sins of the whole congregation of Israel. And that was important, of course. The Leviticus chapter 4, verse 13 through 15 gives an indication of that. They are also, as I mentioned, judges in civil and disciplinary cases. Ruth 4 and Boaz, that situation might be a classic example there. They cast their judgment at the gate. In Proverbs 31, the so-called worthy woman proverb there, it says that her husband is known at the gates. He sits among the elders of the land. And there is that's a role. That's not just, you know, he's sitting there having coffee and shooting the breeze and talking about their latest fishing trip. That's not what they're doing. They're sitting there in a role, in a responsible role for the community, serving as judges, arbiters for the cases that are brought before them. In lieu of a court system like what we have today, they served as the judges and the court, if you will, of those people. And so we see this expression, the elders of the city, the elders of the people, the elders of the nation. That was common in the Old Testament. We see direct teaching. We see discipline. We see oversight of the people as being those things that those elders did. And of course, you have an ideal presentation or an excellent description of that there in Job 29, verse 7 through 17, which was already read for us. Job says, I was in the prime of my days, and literally in the Hebrew, it's the autumn of my days there. In verse 4 of that passage, just before that passage, and literally he talks about the season of maturity, referring to a time of a late summer harvest and full of fruit and abundance. In other words, I had a lot to offer. So as opposed to what we think of maybe older people today, like they're exhausted, they're depleted, they don't have anything left to offer because they're no longer working or because, you know, they're no longer breadwinners for their families and so on. So therefore, they're all used up. That's the idea some people have of the older people, and that's just not true. Ideally speaking, anyway, Job says quite the opposite. I was a fruitful harvest, ready to be gleaned, ready to be, you know, to offer something here. I was in the prime of my life. And the idea there, of course, would be that it took time and experience and accumulation of knowledge for him to get there as well. We could say then of elders in general in the Old Testament, they were wise, they were experienced, they were honored men and honorable men. They were spiritual leaders and teachers. They were influential but fair. They offered sound judgment. They offered sound advice. They were prominent leaders and examples. They were the mentors to the young people. I realize we're talking ideally here, so we're talking positively, which is good because that's how we should see them, in a positive light. They also comprise the essential component of social, religious, and the political structure of Israel. in this at least threefold perspective. First of all, they are respectable. They maintained a certain noble and honorable conduct and lifestyle. Okay? They didn't bring reproach on themselves or the people. They didn't bring reproach on their age group, if you will, on their profession, for lack of a better term, their responsibility. But they were, whoops, I don't want to go ahead yet. They were responsible here as far as God holding them accountable to those things, in guiding and overseeing the people. They were also representative in the sense that they represented God to the people. Elders represented the ideal, mature or immature perspective of what it meant to be a leader in a city, in a tribe, even in the family. They had a work to do. And again, we're kind of addressing the question here, what if we didn't have them? What if we didn't have that? What if Israel didn't have that? And what if we didn't have that now? Well, you know, we could survive, but we would be severely handicapped and we would be very short-sighted. I have said for many years, history was my major in college, and so I have a fondness for history itself, but my perspective here is that we need to have a connection to history, and elders help to provide a connection to history. I don't mean just far-off ancient history, but even the history of our lifetime and our recent generations. We need to know what happened. We need to know, keep the historical lessons and the perspectives alive. And often it is through the older people, not the younger, but the older people, that that is done. We need those who are eyewitnesses to the past, who are filled with experience and perspective. A lot of young people, and I'm speaking very generally, not necessarily our young people, but young people in general, tend to think that they're just living in the here and now, and that that's all that's important. What's going on in my life is all that matters. What's going on in my generation is all that matters. What's going on with, you know, my technological gadgetry and, you know, my computer-filled world, that's all that matters to me. Not realizing that it wasn't that long ago when we didn't have all that stuff, for one. And when history really was known to the people and was taught as an honorable subject rather than some boring thing that you had to learn when you're sitting in junior high, okay? History meant something because, as you well know the quotes, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And that has as much weight today as it ever did. And this society, including our society within the churches, if you will, the young people, as an age group within the church, if we don't learn from society, then we are doomed to repeat all the mistakes and the mishaps and the rebellion of the ancient societies, the older societies that shook their fist at God and demanded a different way and then suffered the consequences of that. We need to understand what is the right way, what is the right path, how are we supposed to walk, which direction are we supposed to go. I'm not saying elders have all the answers or the elderly people have all the answers. What I'm saying, though, is that they are, or should be at least, the most learned and the most the wisest of the group, and we should listen to them for that reason, okay? If indeed they are prepared, which gets to the latter part of the lesson, what about when they're not? What effect does that have? Well, it's not good. Elders, as part of the institution of society and the congregation of Israel, had a work to do. When they forsook that work, there were direct and negative consequences. Just because someone is an old man, for example, doesn't mean that he's righteous, doesn't mean that he's godly. Some of the elders actually offer just the opposite examples and led to or contributed to a dysfunctional society. Not always are the sinful lifestyles outward. Sometimes they are internal, and then they manifest themselves in outward behavior, as you see up on the screen. Some elders succumbed to the neglect of their God-given duties. Some had apathy toward the moral condition of the people. They didn't care. They're just there for themselves, gleaning whatever they can, exploiting the people however they can. Some had irreverence toward God and his temple. Read the book of Malachi, for example, or the book of Ezekiel, or Jeremiah, or Isaiah, or a number of the different prophets, and you'll see that. The ignorance of God's law and earlier instructions. Some of the elders were there. They were not learned men, but rather ignorant. In fact, we can safely say that one reason, not the only reason, but one reason for the corruption of the Israel and the fall of Judah was the elders were simply not doing their work. They were not doing their responsibility. They were not teaching the people as they should have done. In Isaiah chapter 3, verse 14 through 15, it says, Jehovah enters into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard, being Israel. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor? Exploiting their weaknesses, capitalizing on their ignorance and treating them as expendable is really what they did. And then God comes in and says, if you're going to treat them that way, then you're going to have to contend with me. And they did. And that didn't go very well for them. Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 11 through 12, we find that one of the abominable scenes that God shows Ezekiel in those series of visions there is that of 70 elders of Judah hiding in the temple of the Lord, offering sacrifice to false gods, and then saying, oh, the Lord doesn't see us. He doesn't see us. And then in the vision of slaughter, which follows in chapter 9, verse 6, Ezekiel sees the angel kill the elders first. The first group of people that is slaughtered is the elders because of their responsibility and their influence. As Jesus said in Luke 12:48, of those to whom much has been given, much is required. In Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 1 through 3, the elders are sitting before Ezekiel saying, well, what does God have to say? And God says, don't listen to them, don't talk to them, don't give them a word because they have idols in their heart. And these are men who are sitting in captivity already for their rebellion against God. Ezekiel 34, verse 1 through 10. I'm going through this quickly. I expect you to look it up on your own anyway because you would do well to do so. Verse 1 through 10 of Ezekiel 34, we have a graphic condemnation of all the shepherds of Israel, the elders, that is, which necessarily included the kings, the priests, the Levites, and the elderly men as well. We'll notice the New Testament uses the word shepherd several times as a designation for the elders. So the whole point here is that when elders are corrupted, when they apostatize, which is a fancy word which means they fall away from the truth, when they fail to do their work, the entire system, the entire congregation of people is negatively affected. And God holds those men responsible and accountable for the welfare of the people. Their personal failures contributed to the national failure of Israel and Judah. And when they failed, the nation failed. In Jeremiah 19, verse 1 through 13, there's a graphic illustration. Jeremiah gathers the elders and senior priests there at the gate, and he has an earthenware jar, and he breaks the jar in front of them and says, God is going to break this people, just like this jar just broke, because of what you have done. That's a pretty sobering condemnation, isn't it? And then Ezekiel chapter 22 and verse 30, God says, I search for a man among them, the Jews, that is, the nation of Judah, who should build up the wall and stand in the gap before me for the land that I should not destroy it, but I found no one. No priest, no prophet, no king, no elder. That is the image of a spiritually dysfunctional society that could no longer function as God's people. It had to be purged. It had to be completely reformed. So we're giving you the positive ideal approach. And then we're saying, well, what happens when it doesn't work? Well, it gets pretty ugly pretty quickly. Okay? So Romans chapter 15, verse 4 says, whatever was written in earlier times was written for what? For our instruction. We're supposed to read those things, not just because it's history and Chad likes history, and so that's why we have to do that. We're reading that because we need that instruction. It is essential for us. The Old Testament portrays elders in both an ideal as well as an abysmal condition. And both of those, positively or negatively, for better or worse, affected the entire congregation of Israel. Well, whatever happened to Israel as a nation certainly can happen to a congregation. If the elders are doing well, then the congregation will typically do well as long as the congregation itself is cooperating with that. But if the elders themselves are morally corrupt, well, that's going to have a very negative effect, possibly even become the ruin of that congregation. And we'll look at that next week in particular, both of those ideas. So the New Testament eldership is simply a modification of what we see in the Old Testament. It's not without precedent, in other words. God didn't just create a new position within the church. He actually took a position that was already in existence in the Jewish society and took that to another level and now put it in a spiritual context rather than just in a civic or national context there or a social context. So let me say in closing here, the elders should be respected and valued for what they have to offer, of course, but they have to have something to offer as well, okay? We can't just say that, well, because you're old, therefore you should be respected. No, because of what you have to offer in your aged time of life, that's why we should respect you and you should have something to offer. God doesn't want just old men overseeing the flock. He wants, as I said earlier, respectable men, responsible men, and representative older men, those who represent him to the people. And as I said before, young people or middle-aged people are not going to wake up one day with such qualities and just become elders. They need to start working on that now, whoever they are, whoever it is that wants to be an elder in the future. And I hope that we have younger men here who are looking toward becoming elders in the future. Okay? I hope this lesson has given us a historical perspective that is helpful, and please remember these things as we go forward in our series so that we can have this kind of as the backdrop, historical backdrop of everything we're going to talk about from this point forward. If there's anyone here that needs to respond to the gospel call, or if you have some spiritual need that we can help you with through our prayers and encouragement, of course, we offer this time in our service for you to respond if you need to. Come forward if you need as we stand and sing the song that Bob has selected for us.